Case number 08-5402, Kevin R. Sanford, appellant versus United States of America. Mr. Fidel for appellant, Ms. Coles-Huff for appellee.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Morning.
It's the day after Constitution Day, and one feels, having heard the last case and about to talk about Mr. Sanford's case, privileged to be able to participate in our ongoing national conversation about the Constitution. A point that I wrestled with in sorting out this case is how the two parts of the prevailing law seem to fit together. In other words, the threshold question of whether the military judicial system has afforded a constitutional issue full and fair consideration, followed by the question of what happens then.
Right. I had exactly the same question. What's the answer?
I think the answer.
In other words, why, if we conclude that there's no constitutional violation, why do we have to address the first question? Is that what you were wondering about also?
Well, I've been wondering. I've having stared at these issues and the. I've been involved in a number of collateral attacks in this court over the years. I've just felt unnourished by the law, and I think the court has, you know, various panels have grappled with this. It's obvious that this is unsettled, and I think that perhaps in the summary disposition phase, I don't know if the panel has looked at the summary disposition papers, but you know, it's clear that there's something that where everyone would benefit, including the various agencies that are involved, by a clearer architecture. And I think I'll just make a couple of observations. I don't have, Judge Tatel, a set piece on this any more than the court has had a set piece. And I'd be kidding the panel if I contended otherwise. I am uncomfortable with the continuing notion that there's something different about collateral review of courts martial than collateral review of other kinds of convictions for constitutional purposes. And
but that's the law of this circuit.
Well, yes, I understand that. In a footnote in our main brief, we quote Senator Kennedy in connection with the 1983 amendments for the proposition that was Congress's understanding that basically a collateral review of military convictions would be subject to the same standards as collateral review of civilian, federal, and state convictions. But I take your point. You haven't misstated the law of the circuit. I think I understand, sympathize, and probably pretty much agree with Chief Judge Lamberth's take on this. The government said this is all very confusing, and in a footnote, page 6 of the Joint Appendix, footnote 5, his take was, well, look, if there's been no full and fair consideration, there's nothing for us to function on. And presume, I don't know what he would do in that circumstance if he found there was, it doesn't hang together properly. Your question is, if there's nothing there at the end of the line, why even bother with phase one? It's a matter of judicial administration. I understand that. I'm sympathetic to it, that you don't want to opine on something that you don't have to. And that may be the case. I understand that.
We did say, didn't we, in our Kaufman decision, that decision that fair, in the phrase full and fair, means conformance with Supreme Court decisions.
Yes, that's correct.
And that seems to be what we've been doing.
That does describe the court's actual behavior. If you read the cases, I mean, you see paragraph after paragraph that sort of grapples with, well, is it enough if there's a formulary affirmance or a denial of review? There's no oral argument that hasn't been fully briefed. But now let's talk about the merits.
In this circuit, it looks as though we have recited what the military court has said.
Yes.
But not in the way that other circuits have, is it? Well, the issue was briefed, it was presented, the
Correct.
Court dealt with it. We've just said, here's what they've done, here's what they said, and then we've gone on to do our own analysis of the constitutional claim.
That's exactly right.
And used from time to time some deferential language that we find no fundamental defect.
Your Honor, that probably is a workable maybe sort of intellectually less than completely satisfying, but it's workable, and I think litigants such as Sergeant Sanford and others who have come before the court could survive and not feel that they've been shortchanged. I mean, that's the real point here, is that people shouldn't feel that they've been shortchanged, because you're the first Article III court, excuse me, the district court in whose shoes you stand, in a way, on de novo review. This is the first opportunity for Article III review for these cases because, as our briefs point out, you can't get to the Supreme Court if the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces denies review.
But, you know, you're right that it is not entirely clear from our opinions how we should wrestle with this. But what about councilmen? In order to avoid a court-martial on collateral review, the error must be, quote, fundamental. How about that? Maybe that's the standard now.
Well, I think...
I mean, that's sort of... The advantage to it is that it's clear, it's the Supreme Court, and it, by saying fundamental, it clearly incorporates the idea of the deference that our circuit and the Supreme Court require we give to military judgments of this kind.
Yes. But I think there is content to that use of the word fundamental.
I was thinking of a situation where suppose a military person had raised a constitutional challenge and the military courts had simply ignored it. And then
there was no footnote the way the Navy court.
No footnote.
Yeah.
and no reference to it even. And then it comes into the district court on collateral attack, and the district court says, well, he did raise this constitutional challenge, and we look at it, and we think there would be a fundamental defect in the proceedings because the challenge has merit. Right? We wouldn't care, in a sense, as I understand it, whether or not the military court had looked at it at all.
I think that's right, and that leads back to my lack of comfort with the way the jurisprudence has at least been articulated. I think that...
So then with that in mind, how would you, in the crispest way you can, tell us why the error here... Let's go to the merits, okay?
Yes.
Why is the construction of the special court-martial here? Why is it a fundamental error?
It's fundamental because we have a decision by the Supreme Court of the United States.
Under the Sixth Amendment?
No, Your Honor, that was under the 14th Amendment. And there's a bit of metaphysics going on here, but it's the part of the 14th Amendment that brings the Sixth Amendment
in. Right.
Yes, but that is correct, but it is the due process clause of the 14th Amendment, and when I see the words due process in the 14th Amendment, my mind, and here I'm thinking of the relationship between Brown against Board of Education and Bowling v. Sharp, there's got to be some harmony between the meaning of the term due process as it appears in the 14th Amendment and the meaning of the term due process as it appears in the Fifth Amendment. That's the...
But Brown wasn't an incorporation case. Brown was a 14th Amendment case. And the question was whether the due process clause of the Fifth Amendment... the question in Bowling was, does the due process clause of the Fifth Amendment mean the same thing as the due process in the 14th? And the court said, yeah, the question here is different.
Touche. But the fact remains, we're still talking about the meaning of due process, and we're talking about the meaning of due process
without the help of the more specific Sixth Amendment right to trial by jury.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Okay. So why is it fundamental?
Because we have a recognition by the Supreme Court of the United States when considering the responsibilities of the 50, should I say, sovereign states under the Constitution to... I'm sorry. or in Congress. it's just been Constitution Day. I'll call them sovereign states, too. There has to be something to the notion that what our governing document, what our national governing document thinks our rock-bottom standards demand of these sovereign states must say something about what we as a country believe is simply fundamental. It's a matter, in a way, it's a matter of respect for the states to say that we're only going to impose on them, see Ballou, things that we really think are fundamental. And when you're talking about the administration of justice in a country where the law has not, that our sort of default mode has not been a single judge sitting on a bench dispensing justice to all who may come, but has always involved some multi-member, non-lawyer decision making. You can call it a jury, you can call it members of a court martial, but our governing principle is that it's not ladies and gentlemen in black robes. So, Judge Tatel, your question's a fair one. That's about as close as I can get to answering it. But, and I see the nasty yellow light has come on.
Can I just back up a little?
Of course.
You're making, you know, what I'll describe as a theoretical argument. All right. Now, the Supreme Court, in reaching its conclusion, looked at all of this empirical evidence that had been developed.
Yes.
And you acknowledge, to some extent, that the court-martial system is not the same in the sense of we're not looking at random selection, we're not looking at a fair cross-section. There's some expertise involved. And I gather your theory would be that nevertheless, when the numbers are small among decision-makers, the same principles that applied in Ballou would apply to any decision-making body, essentially.
Assume
that would be your position. Don't you have some burden to put evidence before the court? I mean, even if it were expert testimony, to suggest that there is some comparability here?
Your Honor, that's...
In order to show it's fundamental, that's all I'm getting at.
Right, and you've, to show that it's fundamental. I think whether it's fundamental or not is a matter of principle rather than the sort of...
The theory is we want fair fact-finding.
Right. That's the fundamental part. Right. So in answer to your question, on page 8 of the joint appendix, Chief Judge Lamberth said that the Supreme Court's assessment of these scholarly studies was restricted to the civilian jury context. That's a direct quote. That's not so. Let me, as I begin this short answer to your question, but that's not what the court said in Ballou. It, of course, is the case that Ballou arose from a civilian criminal trial, but the opinion does not restrict it to...
The only studies were, in fact, civilian studies. There are no military studies, are there?
Uh, As far as I know, the studies were sort of garden variety.
If there were studies, you would have told us about.
Absolutely. And I know of no such studies. Now to get to Judge Rogers' question, the nub of it. Our position, Judge Rogers, is that the burden is on the government to show that the group dynamic studies don't describe military behavior or the behavior of people who have chosen this walk of life, rather than on us to prove that they do. If you ask me what the heart of this case is, what it pivots on, it is on that burden. And I believe...
Because of your due process and incorporation argument.
Yes.
So
that's where it is. And as our papers explain, in our society, although as the Supreme Court has repeatedly instructed us, the military is a separate and distinct society, and there are respects in which there are norms of behavior, which, by the way, the framers of the UCMJ have been quite careful about protecting against, like command influence, that unlawful command influence, that kind of concern, and that rank not play a role. The fact remains that we have a citizen army. It is not a caste. These are our fellow citizens and non-citizens, by the way. We have many non-citizens in the army and the military. And I think I will say, contrary to our values and contrary to public policy, to treat these individuals as so different that group dynamics, the normal, hardcore group dynamics that the social scientists on which the blue opinion relied, don't apply. And I think the onus is on the government to show, no, look, people are basically different. As far as the, and now I'll be done in 20 seconds, as far as the function and selection issues, I think we've exhaustively examined that, and I will, to use a somewhat, I'm not going to say blah, 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 that was a no-no from the last case, I will say it walks like a duck, as this court has said. If you look at every essential characteristic of the functioning of military juries, looks, walks, talks, and functions like a jury. Thank you very much.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Doris Coles Huff on behalf of the United States. I'm joined by Assistant United States Attorney Craig Lawrence and Lieutenant Mark Bruin of the United States Navy Office of the Judge Advocate General. This court has set forth a two-part test for constitutional challenges to a court-martial, and the government has met both parts of that test here.
Do you have anything to add to our discussion about why it's a two-part test and why we even need to address the first question if we think there's no constitutional flaw in what happened?
Well, I would agree that... I think the test is for probably ease of administration. Looking at the various decisions on this matter, I think all have agreed that it's been hard to come to terms with just how to administer the standards that the Supreme Court set forth in Burns and Councilman. And so I think that the two-part test set up by this circuit is just for ease of administering these standards.
But look at what we said in Priest. This was right after Councilman. Basically, we said that whether a judgment may be deemed void turns on two factors, all right, that everybody quotes. But then we went on and said that if Priest's interpretation of the First Amendment is correct, then the defect is sufficiently fundamental to void the judgment of conviction. And then we went on to look at the constitutional arguments that he presented. And we found they were unpersuasive, and that was the end of it. one way to look at how we have discussed these cases, and along the lines of saying we don't even look at sort of this full and fair, the full aspect. We just look at the fair aspect as Kaufman had described it.
I think that probably is correct. In some instances, it may also be that there were other factors that made it clear to the court that full consideration was given by the military courts. But I would agree that if the court determines initially that there is no fundamental defect, then it wouldn't be necessary to back up and look at the consideration given it by the military court.
Well, do you read our Priest decision as basically saying that's the limit of our authority? In other words, adopting the test that was laid out in counsel?
I would say that Priest maybe didn't make it explicit. I think that in New, this court made the standard more explicit to
I thought just the reverse. I thought Priest made it very explicit, and then New comes along and essentially ends up doing the same thing, but it's not as explicit about it. I mean, that's just my reading of it. And you
I guess I would say that the in New too, this court made it clearer as to what is expected. What has been done certainly has varied from decision to decision in the, as far as how
what New said, all right?
Yes.
Said, talking about councilmen, that the errors must be fundamental to void a court-martial judgment on collateral review. And in light of Councilman's point that non-habeas review is, if anything, more deferential than habeas review of military judgments, a military court's judgment clearly will not suffer such a defect if it satisfies Burns' fair consideration test. You think that's clearer than Priest? I give it to you. But anyway, that's just one reading of it. So. Your answer to Judge Tatel is we may not need to look at the first part?
My answer to Judge Tatel would be that you may not need to look at the first part, but in this instance, we have met both prongs. So it wouldn't, you know, you can look at it in either order. Both prongs of the test have been met.
Why don't you, what's your answer to Mr. Fidel's argument that, look, even if the standard is a fundamental error, here we have the Supreme Court quite clearly finding a fundamental error in the civilian jury context. And if it's fundamental there, why isn't it fundamental here? That's his argument.
Well, this is...
I mean, I understand there's differences between civilian and military juries. We all accept that.
Right.
And the court clearly would not have come out the way it did in the civilian jury case if it hadn't viewed the defects in the jury, the size of the jury there, as a fundamental flaw, right?
The Supreme Court has held that the Sixth Amendment does not apply in the military context. The decision in Ballou is based on the Sixth Amendment. It's based on empirical studies done.
You think the military could abolish juries altogether?
Don't think it.
Why not?
I think that
suppose it just decided we're not going to. They had all the procedures. They had right to counsel. They had appeals. Right to confront the witnesses against you. All the rules, all the solid rules of due process. But no juries.
I believe that as long as it met standards or conforms with Supreme Court standards, it might not matter how it's construed or how it's composed.
I'm not sure I understand. What Supreme Court standards? You mean for due process? For procedural due process? Look, your argument, I only asked the question because of the way you answered my question. your answer to my question is that was a Sixth Amendment case. This is a Fifth Amendment case. So why, if you're right, and you're absolutely right about that, why couldn't the military abolish military juries?
I think Congress under its Article 1, under Article 1, would have the authority to do so, but it would still have to conform to Supreme Court standards.
What Supreme Court standards?
I'm sorry?
What Supreme Court standards?
Well, Supreme Court standards respecting due process. Oh, Congress would still be subject to the due process clause. And so there wouldn't be any absolute restrictions on how Congress could chooses to set up a military judicial system, but it would still have to conform to due process requirements. Again, I think...
How about the right not to incriminate yourself? No, I'm serious. Your argument is that if it's anything that's specifically enumerated in the amendments isn't covered by due process, is that your point?
I'm sorry. Can you repeat the question?
I take it your point is that there's a separate constitutional amendment for right to trial by jury, right?
Correct.
And this is just a Fifth Amendment case, not a Sixth Amendment case.
That's correct.
So could the military require people to incriminate themselves? In other words,
the military would that be due process? Would that be a full and fair and impartial trial if individuals?
I'm just trying to tease out the limits of your argument. That's all.
I think the military wouldn't want to do that. The military wouldn't want to do anything that would impose upon an individual's right to a fair and impartial trial. And I don't think the military is intentionally trying to do that. What the Congress has done here is set up a system that has procedural safeguards. I mean, there's no reason not to want to give members of the military certain protections. And based on the Constitution, Congress is mandated to give certain protections. But do we have to have a particular system that mirrors the civilian system? No.
At least not absent some evidence that there are similar flaws. I mean, that's, as I understood the Wolf decision, the military court's point was, much as we've been discussing here, there isn't any empirical evidence to show we have a problem or the same type of problem because of the nature of who's sitting on these juries.
I think that's correct. I think that Wolf indicates that there are differences between a civilian jury and a military court-martial panel, that the manner in which a military court-martial panel is selected is very distinct and has inherent procedural safeguards that are not implicated by the factors that the Supreme Court looked at in Blue.
Do you agree it's your burden?
I believe it is the plaintiff's burden as one challenging the composition of the court martial to show that, consistent with the Supreme Court standard set forth in Millendorf versus Henry, the plaintiff would have to, or the appellant here would have to show that the factors in favor of a six, factors militating in favor of a six-member court-martial panel are so weighty that the balance struck by Congress should be changed here. So I think that is the appellant's burden to show that and challenge.
He cites a Supreme Court case that talks about just the dynamics of decision making and how they vary depending on the size of the group that has to make the decision.
Yes, and he cites a case that has no application here.
Even as to the fundamental proposition that I just stated?
I'm sorry. I think I didn't follow your...
Well, you say it's his burden. He cites a Supreme Court case which basically says that the group dynamics of decision-making are adversely affected as the size of the group grows smaller.
He says it's our burden. He cites a Supreme Court case. We say that the Supreme Court decision in Ballou doesn't apply because the Sixth Amendment doesn't apply to military court-martials. But even if we were to look at the factors that the...
Suppose in Ballou there had been a study that said any time you have a group of people who have to find facts and make a decision, you need at least six or more people because all of our sociological and psychological analysis shows that you will not, on balance, get fair decision-making when there are fewer than six people.
If there were...
Suppose that's what he had. Then what would the government's burden be?
The government's burden would be to show a distinction between the standard there and the circumstances here, which I believe we have done in any regard. We have shown that Congress, in this instance, in dealing with military affairs, is entitled to a great degree of deference.
You think if Congress knew that studies show that you can't have fair fact-finding with less than six people, they would still authorize fact-finding by less than six people? I mean, history shows 13 or more.
I think that Congress would try to find a way to ensure that fairness, notwithstanding the number of people. There have to be other things that can be done, and I think those things have been done here, given the manner in which a military court-martial is impaneled.
So your analysis is basically that even if you have the burden, you've met it under sort of the Weiss-Militov standard, and then the burden shifts back to the plaintiff to come forth with some evidence, and he hasn't done that.
That's correct. I see my time is up, and I would just state that the appellant here is essentially asking this court to establish a new rule that military courts-martials must consist of a minimum of six members. I think that that request should be rejected, and the decision of the district court should be affirmed.
Thank you. Counsel for appellant?
Two points, Your Honors. First, there was nothing in the setting of this case that made it infeasible for the convening authority for this trial to proceed with a jury of six. How do we know that? Because the convening authority detailed six people to the panel.
How does that relate to your constitutional argument?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
How does that relate to your constitutional argument?
I'm responding to the government's suggestion that it would be that's what I was driving at there. The other is the assumption that somehow one set of group dynamics would apply when a, let's say, 19-year-old or 20-year-old citizen of the District of Columbia is summoned to sit in the jury box. And a different kind of group dynamics, that the operating system, or the hard wiring changes somehow the next year when that patriotic young woman or young man enters the Navy and is selected by a convening authority to sit on a court-martial panel. And then 4 years later, when that now veteran returns to the District of Columbia jury roll, or the Maryland or Virginia jury roll, to make the analogy closer, that the operating system changes back, and now the BALU studies sort of kick in again and are pertinent again. I think that that's a distortion of what I believe common sense suggests about human nature and group dynamics. And I do believe that the burden can properly be placed on the government to explain why the generic understanding that the Supreme Court embraced based on the social science data in the BALU case should not also apply to this lesser, smaller population. If the court has no further questions, that completes my presentation.
Thank you. We'll take the case under advisement.
Thank you.